Basically, what's going on? We're putting together this podcast related specifically to, you know, to this one Alice record, Journey and Sat Chit Ananda. And I've spoken to a few people. I spoke to the producer. I spoke to a couple of the musicians who played on the studio portion of the record. And I'm really just kind of hoping to fill in as many details as I can about, you know, sort of, you know, where Alice's, you know, mindset was at the time and just sort of the background of everything. And now I know that your history with Alice goes back, you know, a good deal further, you know, to this like Detroit period. And I'm wondering if you could sort of take me back to that period and just describe a little bit about, you know, how you first came to know her or became aware of her, just what that whole scene was like that you were both coming out of in Detroit.
Yeah, it's a transition. I knew her in Detroit because several musicians and I, among them Charles McPherson, Roy Brooks, drummer, Lonnie Haley, who played with Charles Mingus, so did McPherson, played with Charles Mingus, but we all lived together in a flat in Detroit, and it was on the campus of Wayne University, and we played all day and all night. And when the musicians would come to town, especially musicians who had left Detroit and hit the big stage in New York, when they came to her, they would always come by and jam in our loft. So Alice came by and she played also. That's how I met her. And also, she comes from a family of artists. Her brother was one of my mentors on the bass, Ernie Farrell. And then she had another brother named Jackie. I think he was a visual artist. And as far as I can remember, Alice came up in the Black church in Detroit. And I liked her playing right away. It had a certain distinction to it, a certain depth. I mean, she met all the requirements. She could swing. She knew the jazz voicings. So she fit right in with Barry Harris and Tommy Flanagan and all the other great pianists who came out of Detroit. It's kind of a tradition that came out of Detroit. And it's unique to Detroit. And Philly has a tradition. All of the great jazz centers across the country, that there's something unique to those communities. Philadelphia, for instance, where Train came out of, there was McCoy Tyner came out of the tradition, the bassist. Alvin Jones was from Detroit, and he came out of that tradition. So once the musicians hit New York, everyone made adjustments according to who they were playing with. So getting back to Alice, I met her in Detroit and we were friends. And then in New York, I got a call from her one day. She was playing with Terry Gibbs, the Bible harpist. And she says, well, do you want a gig? I said, well, I don't have a gig at the moment. And she says, well, I got a gig for you with Terry Gibbs. I said, well, I don't really know his music. But she said, well, and the reason she called me is because I was classically trained, and the bassist who was playing with the group at that time was coincidentally one of my mentors from Detroit. But she wasn't happy with his playing. I won't mention his name. So she called me because he was playing out of tune and she knew I could play in tune. So I got the gig and we toured with Terry Gibbs for I think about a year. And that was an interesting gig because it was kind of a show. It was a show band because she played piano, Gibbs played the vibes, and then she'd get up and play the vibes and they would do a duet, a contest on the vibes. And that was kind of his format. And we actually opened for John Coltrane at Birdland, which was the main stage in New York. Anybody who was anybody in the jazz scene played Birdland. So, I took the gig with playing, and we opened for Train many times at Birdland. So once we were sitting in a booth, Alice and I, and Train was on, and when he came over and said, oh, he said, y'all sure make a nice couple. I said, well, I think maybe you should sit down. I'm leaving. And that's how they came together, okay? So after that gig, I sort of lost track of Alice. I think she went to Europe for a while. And the next call I got from her is I came back from Morocco. I was over there for a year and I started to play the oud over there. I studied over there. Anyway, she says, called up and she says, I hear you playing the oud. I say, well, yeah, well, I'm trying to play it. It's not easy. Well, I'd been playing with Pharoah Saunders and she was tuned in with him. And one thing led to another. And we got together for a while and I could see that she was having, you know, a hard time psychologically post John Coltrane. He had passed. So I asked her if she wanted to meet my guru. And she said, well, yeah. So I took her and she met, introduced her to Satchitananda, and the rest is kind of history. They clicked and all of a sudden she told me she was doing a journey into Satchitananda. I said, really? That was kind of fast. Anyway, she had everything figured out and sure enough, the track that I'm on was recorded at the Village Gate in New York. I don't know where the other session took place, but on that session, when she asked me to record, I had some reservations about the recording because I was playing the oud, which is a Middle Eastern instrument, and the Eastern tonality is different than the Western tonality. So I'm trying to figure out how we're going to play together. So I said, okay, I'll make the adjustment. I won't play the quarter tones or the semi-quarter tones when I play with the musicians. And I didn't know who was going to be on the date. I don't remember us rehearsing either. So the date, as you know, it's Pharoah Saunders, Alice, of course, and Rashid Ali on drums and Charlie Hayden on bass. So that was the group. And all I remember is sitting out front and playing one of my compositions, and it ended up being the longest composition on the whole album. And it was very interesting for me to make the adjustments with that instrument because I had never recorded an instrument before. So I had to figure out how to make it work. And that's what we do as musicians. Whatever situation we're thrown into, make it work. Fortunately, I think it worked. Okay. And that was at the Village Gate. The rest of the recording, I've listened to it many times and I love it. I like especially Alice's harp playing. When I knew her before she married John Coltrane, she wasn't playing the harp. I mean, I left something out. I lived on the east side of Detroit. Not many musicians came from the east side, but Alice played with a group with a trombonist named George Bohannon, who ended up going to the West Coast. He's one of the best musicians in New York. And she played the organ. And I can't remember who the drummer was. And they had a trio. I believe it was, I can't remember the name of the trio.
The Premieres? I think it was called the Premieres.
Okay, Premieres, yeah. They were playing couple of blocks from my house in Detroit. I wasn't old enough to go in, but she and I are the same age. I don't know how she got in. I guess because she's playing the organ. Anyway, I went to the back door and listened to them. I said, wow, these dudes can really cook. So that's the first time I actually heard her. I forgot about that. So getting back to the recording, I listened to the rest of the recording. I like all the musicians. It's an interesting choice that she made. Because Cecil McBee is one of the among the best bassists in New York. And Rashid Ali is kind of a free drummer. He doesn't really play in the mainstream of the music. So I knew him for playing out. And then Pharoah, I played with Pharoah. So I knew where he's coming from musically. But what I really liked about the album, I thought it was a good mix in terms of the choice of musicians. Is Alice's harp playing. I had played with a harpist in Detroit named Dorothy Ashby. She played the harp, she played the piano, and she sang. But her approach to the harp was traditional. Alice's approach to the harp is far from traditional. And what she does with the instrument was sensational for me because she got all kind of colors and it was kind of an astral sound, if astral makes any sense to you. For instance, Sun Ra, he travels in space. Her music kind of took place, it took me to the space, which is infinite, okay? And I know Alice's depth from knowing her all that time, especially playing with Terry Gibbs, where you play every night with the same person. When we played with Terry Gibbs, when he would finish his solo, we would change the harmony and make it more innovative. And so we had a lot of fun playing with him. So she certainly was an excellent musician. And I would say extraordinary, excellent musician. I really liked her as a pianist and later as a harpist. And that's kind of our experience regarding the album.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to hear, because it seems like you're one of the few people who really kind of bridged that whole period. Because for many people, you know, they probably weren't aware of her before she came on the scene in John's band, and they weren't as aware of her, you know, the early period, because she wasn't making recordings under her own name or wasn't as easy to hear if you weren't actually in Detroit. So it seems like you had a really, you know, a broad exposure to all sides of what she was doing and where she really came out of that Detroit scene that you were describing.
Yeah, because before she met John, she was married to a singer now, I believe his name was Pancho Haygood. And he was a vocalist, but he had a substance problem. And so that didn't last. And I think that's when maybe the two of them were in Europe together. And I think she stayed in Europe and studied. So yeah, I do have a different knowledge of Alice and her concepts in music, her training in music. She's very well trained, and the depth of her music. There's something very deep about her music. And I don't know where that comes from, but it's there. And that's one of the things I love about her playing. Her ability to her music connected with people. And that's a real skill. Not every musician can do that. I played with Alberta Hunter also, and she did that. Of course, she was an actress and a singer, so that was more available to her. Alice was also a singer, because of the group I heard, they were singing mostly, but there were also were excellent musicians when she was playing the organ on the east side of Detroit. So she's definitely one of my favorites of all time, of all the pianists coming out of Detroit. And we have a whole lineage of pianists coming out of Detroit. And Barry Harris is kind of the center, because he was the bebop man. Well, she played bebop very well, but she had her own concept of playing music. So she was kind of different than the rest of the pianists came out of Detroit. Tommy Flanagan and Hank Jones and all those guys, they sort of came out of the bebop tradition. She was bebop, but she was something else. She had a different concept. She heard a different, she was marching to a different drummer, as we say.
That's all very insightful, and I really appreciate you sharing that. I would like to talk to you a little bit about you spoke about Alice's when you heard from her later on, that you were talking about where her head was at and kind of her mindset in the wake of John's death. And I'm very interested in that, because I've heard a lot about how she was sort of deep into meditation. She was kind of looking deep inside herself and trying to kind of find a way forward. Can you just talk to me a little bit more about how you said that she was going through a difficult time, or what state she was in emotionally, you know, in the midst of all that after John's death?
Well, she felt very heavy. In other words, not at peace with herself. And, you know, if you're not at peace with yourself, you're not at peace with other people. You got to get your house straight before you can step out and be who you are. So I think I've thought a lot about it. I don't want to jump to conclusions, but I think from a musical perspective that playing with John was difficult for her, because I think anybody playing with John, with few exceptions, would have a difficult time. There's certain recordings where people were playing with John. For instance, when he recorded Giant Steps, the musicians sort of know what's up on the street. So when he recorded Giant Steps, he called the musicians up and asked them to make the date. And the pianist said, "Well, what are we going to play, John?" He said, "Oh, it's all easy stuff. You don't have to worry about nothing. We'll have a little rehearsal." Well, Giant Steps is one of the hardest songs that he ever wrote. So when he made the recording, some of the musicians were struggling, and one of them even got lost and had to come out as a solo. So fast forwarding that information that was common knowledge, because it's documented, okay? So I think that she had a tough time with that musical relationship. And also, they were married, so that's a whole other dimension, you know? And his music was changing very fast. I went to the Village Vanguard to hear him, and I couldn't take what he was playing because it was so emotional, but I couldn't leave. The music pinned me to the wall, and she was in the group. So I could imagine, I won't say struggle, I won't say difficult, but I'll say both, to play with John Coltrane. Because even to listen to him, he was everybody's idol among the musicians and beyond. But I couldn't imagine playing with him. And we opened for him at Birdland many times. And that's 6 days a week. That's every night you plan and you listen to John Coltrane during your intermission. So she had listened to him many times. So for her to be thrown into the spotlight with him, that was a whole nother dimension. So she had to try and meet that level. And I don't think that level was attainable for most people. I'm hoping I'm answering your question.
Well, yeah, and then to have that musical challenge, and then to obviously then to have their personal relationship, and then to have him pass, you know, only a few years after they had met, then she's got this extra sort of emotional burden that she's bearing after that, and then also obviously with the several children born.
Yeah, but then she's got a whole lot. That's a heavy load to carry, okay, for anyone. That's a very heavy load to carry. She's got to carry the, I'm trying to find the right word. She's trying to find the strength and courage to carry on his mission, okay? And that's sort of evidenced in the music that she played after his passing. It was very much, his spirit was in the music. His musical concepts were in the music, and he had many. Some people said that he composed using mathematics. That was new to me, but it makes sense. But I'm sure it was very hard for her to carry on the domestic load and the professional mode and everything that entailed. That would have been too much for most people. I mean, she told me some things personal, that she told me he slept with his horn. So I tried to imagine sleeping with the bass. But the way he played that horn, I believed it. He sort of played the keys off the horn. I mean, no one could quite figure out what he was playing. I came up with Joe Henderson in Detroit, who was also an excellent saxophonist. He didn't try to play like Train, but he played in some ways as well as Train. He came close, for me, to that tradition. But what I'm saying is, after John died, she, as best she could, she used the musicians who had played with him, like Jimmy Garrison, Rashid Ali, and she tried to push the music forward in a direction that he would wanted it taken.
So when you sort of reconnected with her and she spoke to you around that time, though, she was open with you that she was kind of struggling. She was having a hard time.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, she intimated that. And I could feel it. I mean, there's a sensitivity between musicians, and when they, you know, when they get together and they discuss certain things, the depth of the issue that we're discussing, like we're discussing how she was feeling and the challenge of trying to find her place and his absence and where she should be trying to take the music. All those kind of things came up. But the main, it wasn't so much what she said, it's how she felt. Because I had been with her in different situations, pre-John, after John, during John's in some cases. So it was a very heavy feeling, emotionally, a feeling that was too much for most people to bear. So I figured the best thing I could do for her, because I was one of the closest members to Satchidananda, I figured that he would be able to give her hope, inspiration, and some peace of mind. And I think he did that. And then I think that's why she was inspired to produce this album that she did. And I think it's very representative of who she was post John Coltrane.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I'd love to hear more about, you know, you spoke about your closeness with Satchidananda. And, you know, for those of us who didn't know him and who weren't closely involved with that community, like, can you just speak a little bit about, you know, what he meant to you and what his, and you know, maybe how he helped you, or just so we can get a sense of like what he did for people as a kind of a leader?
Well, he was my first guru. I was exposed to yoga very early. A friend of mine and a mentor of mine, a bassist, who gave me the gig with Dorothy Ashby in Detroit. That's before I left Detroit. Gave me a book on yoga. So I became vegetarian before I left my mother's house. And she's very upset because she was a chef. She didn't figure why I was eating vegetables and not eating her pig feet. Anyway, to put some humor into the whole thing, I'm trying to remember exactly what your question was now. Oh yeah, okay. Could you ask it a different way?
Yeah, I basically.
Okay, I got it. Yeah. Okay, back. Okay, so when I met Satchidananda, I had already been practicing yoga for quite a bit. And I think Peter Max, the artist, brought him over from Calcutta around 1966. And he had an institute uptown New York. And I started taking classes, and he actually taught the classes, which was unusual because no guru taught a class, and it was called integral yoga. So it integrated the seven limbs of yoga into one concept. And he was teaching the classes, so it was very hands-on. So he had a lot of retreats where we went and just spent time with him. And we woke up early in the morning with him leading a meditation. And he gave a lot of what we call satsang, which is music, spiritual guidance. And a lot of his disciples, including me, had many issues. And he was able to kind of perceive what our issues was and address them in his own way and help us through his mentoring, through his compassion, through all of the things he was able to perceive, and all of the he was very insightful. So he could kind of sense what your problem was, and you could, if you went one-on-one with him, you could tell him what your problem was, and he would give you a solution. I was in a situation once, and it was really going very bad. It was very painful, and I'd been with him for a long time. So I went to see him, and he says, well, give the person an ultimatum. That's what you have to do. And you have to keep continuing your practice to give you strength, guidance, and so you can make the right decisions. So I had a guru after him. His name was Guru Maharaji, and he was very different. He wasn't as hands-on. He had more disciples. He came from a holy family. So if I was to compare the two gurus, I think I got more guidance for life out of Satchidananda. So I wasn't surprised that when he and Alice got together, he was able to emotionally get to the depth of her problem and give her hope and to encourage her to move forward and to provide her with the tools to move forward. I'm sure he felt the same heaviness and depth from her that I felt. But he being a master, he had the tools that I certainly didn't have to give her all the incentive to move forward. And she was able to do that. So that's why we're having this conversation. If I can go any deeper, let me know.
Oh no, that's fascinating. And I mean, it is pretty profound because, you know, for her to go to the point of actually naming the record after him and sort of, you know, kind of helping to like popularize this connection that she had with him, it shows how significantly this impacted her. And, you know, the fact that you were the one who kind of made that connection, it's pretty profound.
Even though I did that, when she told me that she was going to do the album and the name of it, I wasn't shocked, but I was very surprised because I didn't understand the depth and the meaning that that connection provided for her and for him. He came to our gigs several times, much to my surprise. I'd never seen him at any gig of any of his disciples, and he had other musicians such as I. He had a huge following, and there were many retreats, 10-day retreats, two-week retreats, where it was just us and the guru. So I don't know if I'm pretty sure she went on retreats with him, but she had a different relationship with him because of who she was. That presented a very different communication and a very different challenge for him, to the point that he came to our gigs and he talked to me about the gig. He wanted to know why I was playing the oud and other instruments and not the bass, because I had played the bass for him. And he was very impressed, okay, when I played the bass for him and a bunch of his disciples. And I always took the bass to retreats and played as part of the meditation that was going on.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you know, because on the other part of the record, she's got this woman Tulsi playing the tambura, the Indian instrument, and then to have you playing the oud. It's interesting how she clearly was thinking outside of a jazz. A more of a conventional jazz instrumentation. Like, did you get the sense that, you know, she wanted to bring the oud in because she wanted to bring in an influence from, you know, non-Western music?
Yeah, absolutely. Because that's something that Train also, he quoted an album called Africa, and he had one that referenced India. So he had already opened that door for her. What I didn't know about Alice is that I didn't know how spiritual she was. I didn't know that she was into meditation because she never revealed that. But it came through her music. And because I was searching, I have a company called Safari East. So once I got into yoga, the Indian music, Ali Akbar Khan, Bismillah Khan, the masters of the Indian music and their stories, it took over my life. it became part of who I was. And then I lived in Morocco for a year. That's where I studied the oud. I studied the oud in New York with a professor from Jordan. He was a PhD. And I studied with him very intently, but I never played the oud traditionally because of the quarter tones and the semi-quarter tones. I had a lot of trouble hearing those. It's not part of Western culture. It's a different concept. And it's a totally different practice in music from Western music. So I had a really hard time playing the oud in the tradition of the oud. And even getting the correct sound, the oud is played with an eagle's feather. That's what they cut, touch the strings with. And I had trouble finding the eagle's feather. I think I had one, but I just couldn't play with it. So yes, I think that she added the oud because she definitely was looking to travel east. And her music, that whole album is kind of universal for me as a musician. And especially her harp playing. I had never heard the harp played with that conviction. The harp is a very difficult instrument. It has pedals on the bottom. When I played with Dorothy Ashby, she was struggling every night to change the chords. The chords on a harp is played from the feet. So she was struggling because she was a short person. She couldn't reach the chords comfortably. So she was struggling all night to make the chord changes because she played the different composers, Gershwin and all the guys. She played all of the 10 Palais tunes, and they all have a bunch of chord changes. So I felt kind of sorry for her every night because she was struggling so hard to play this huge instrument. So when Alice played it, she played it kind of effortlessly because she took it someplace else. She took it to the universe, actually, for me. Okay, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I had heard that she had received the harp from John, but do you think that she was also influenced by Dorothy Ashby?
I would think so, because Dorothy Ashby was the only person in Detroit that played the harp, to my knowledge. She also played the piano and she sang, but the harp was her main focus. So it's very feasible that Alice heard her, because Detroit's not that large. And the music community, everyone sort of knows what everyone's doing. It's that small. And it's interesting because when I came up, which was a long time ago, and when Alice came up and Aretha Franklin and all those people, the music was in the street. I mean, people working at Ford Motor Company or Chevrolet or General Motors, they knew the music. And when you played, you better play it right. Okay, so everybody knew everything in Detroit. So it's quite possible. I'm sure she heard Dorothy Ashby, because Dorothy Ashby was among the best musicians in Detroit. She had perfect pitch. And every night that I played with her, it was agony because I was studying with two guys in Detroit Symphony, and I knew I played in tune, but she was accusing me of playing out of tune because when people opened the door, the harp would go out of tune. So that was an ongoing struggle with the harp. So I didn't have that problem with Alice. I don't know how she kept the harp in tune, but listening to the album, one of the best features for the album, aside from the fact that it's pretty celestial in terms of where it takes people. I know where it takes me, okay? But the other thing is that it's well in tune. The tambour, Tulsi the tambour, she was a follower of Satchitananda also. So that's very important. She was able to play the tambour in tune, and the other musicians were of the caliber that they were able to relate to that instrument and make sure that they played in tune. Because the tambour is, in Indian music, it's the drone instrument, and that's the universal sound. And that's another reason that Alice used that instrument, because I played the tambour also. In fact, after she made that recording, I did several gigs with her, and I played the tambour, I played the oud, I played many instruments with her. And it was very natural for me because that's who I became as a musician through my yogic practice and through my musical interest and my musical taste. And I've still reverend all of the masters from the Indian culture, from the Japanese, the Asian cultures, all of the cultures, and especially the African cultures. I don't know if you know it, but we toured 14 countries through West Africa, Middle East, and North Africa with Randy Weston. And I heard the greatest African music. And African music is part of the Eastern concept of music and tonality. So yeah, I think the album's very special myself.
Can you just say a little bit more? You know, you use the word celestial. Like, is there like anything more you can say about it, the album's effect on you when you hear it, like as a listener? Like, where does it take you?
Well, it takes me to a place where I would like to be all the time, and I'm sort of there as much as I need to be, but you know, I have to go out. If I was a recluse, living in a cave somewhere, I could be in that place all the time. But the album takes me in that place of meditation, quiet. It's inspirational because it has a certain depth to it. It has a depth that I think when people listen to it, some who are not attracted or motivated to meditation, they may not be able to deal with it, okay? But if for the people who are searching for some kind of peace, I think that album certainly will take them there. It takes me there. Especially her harp playing and the tambour. I mean, the tambour is a meditative instrument. Many of the gurus, they play the tambour as they do their meditation. So I think that's the answer to your question.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. The Zoom is going to run out here, so I just want to ask you a couple quick clarifying question. Just really quick, that time when you said you were at Birdland with where you're playing opposite John and you were sitting in the booth. So am I to understand that was the first time that John and Alice met? You were actually present?
Well, the thing is that they had a chance to listen to each other six nights a week on probably six or seven occasions that we opened for him at Birdland. I mean, it was such a honor to open and share the stage with John Coltrane and to be able to hear him every night, every second, every note. And the thing about John that people kind of took issue with is he never said anything about the music or about the group, and everyone wanted to hear him speak. You know, it's kind of important. Some musicians talk too much. But he didn't talk at all, and his music was kind of overwhelming because of the way it came at you, especially after he stopped playing traditional. Quick story: Train played with Miles for a long time, and Train was Miles' favorite musician. So Miles had a gig in Europe, I think it's Sweden, Switzerland, one of those albums. So he called John and said, "Hey John, I got this gig and I want you to make it." He said, "Well, Miles," he said, I'm trying to do my own thing right now. And I, you know. So Miles said, "Come on, John, make this gig." So John said, "Well, why don't you call Wayne Shorter or somebody, one of the young guys?" So he ended up making the gig. And if you hear the album, he played out the whole gig. He played traditional at all. So that was to tell Miles, don't call me anymore because I'm going someplace else.
Yeah. Exactly. Just real quick. I'm sorry the timer's running on this thing, but do you have any other recollections of that of the actual Village Gate performance where that one track was recorded? Anything else come to mind about that?
I don't remember a rehearsal for the gig, which is unusual because it was being recorded, right? So any recording, unless it's a group that plays together all the time, on the road or something, they can go in the studio. I did that with Randy Weston. We went in the studio and did a recording. No rehearsal, no nothing, because we played together every night for many, many years. What was unusual about that is it's the longest recording, because I think it was a feeling out process going on before I actually stated the melody. I was playing the melody for the song. I think everyone on the stage was trying to figure out how to blend the sounds together, because I don't remember a sound check either. So
actually, sorry, Vishal, I'm sorry. The timer on this thing's gonna run out. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna stop it and then I'm gonna send you another video. We could talk for about 5 more minutes. How's that?
Fine.
Okay, I just didn't want to get cut off on the recording. I'll send a Zoom right in just a minute. I'll send another link. Thank you so much. Okay, bye-bye.
You're welcome. Okay.